This episode of the Inner Hoa Uprising is sponsored by you. That's right, you. All of your Patreon donations, PayPal donations, five-star reviews on Apple and Stitcher, shoutouts on social media, articles, mentions to your friends, IHU merchandise purchases, all make this show possible week in and week out. Thank you very much, homies. Welcome to the Inner Hoa Uprising, the podcast about sex, love, and dating from the perspective of me, Sam, one black, non-monogamous, pansexual, feminist hoe who lives in New York City, who is from New York City, not like you fake-ass motherfuckers who claim bacon, egg, and cheese, and bodega cat, and all this and that, whose pronouns are she and her, and who did this intro three times, so she's a little bit aggy.
And me, Rava God, one agender feminist firefighter with a fatty, pronouns they, them, and daddy. Also did this intro three times, but I memorized it this time. So we made it. We out here. Gang, gang.
Very important. Very important. Every episode of the Inner Hoa Uprising works like this. Myself and my lovely rotating co-host talk about sex, love, and dating as it pertains to current events in the world, our lives, and yours. And occasionally we hit you with interviews with insightful folks or do deep dive episodes on a topic of our choice. So on today's episode, the dancers have had e-fucking enough. Specifically, the dancers in the city that has the most strip clubs per capita. We're talking about Portland today. And we're talking about the Portland strippers and labor organizers who are leading the PDX stripper strike. PDX, if you don't know, is a shorthand for Portland. This is a movement that seeks to create fair working conditions for Black and Indigenous sex workers. So stay tuned because we're going to hear all about the movement from today's guest, Kat. Kat is the founder of the Haymarket Pole Collective, a group of autonomous sex workers working for the equitable treatment of Black and Indigenous folks in the adult entertainment industry.
If you would like to follow on along the conversation had in this podcast on social media, you can do so by using the hashtag InnerHoaUprising so we can see it and the hashtag PodIn so other people can see it. And if you would like to follow us on social media, you can do so. That's InnerHoaUprising without the G on Twitter, InnerHoaUprising with the G on Facebook and Instagram. And you can join our Facebook group by searching InnerHoaUprising Community. That's spelled C-U-M-M. UNITY. And also head to innerhoaurising.com to pay a hoe.
Yes. If you want to pay us to speak virtually at your school or conference about sex positivity, Black feminism, podcasting, or other kinds of topics we discuss on this here show, or if you would like us to host a consent, pleasure, or dating virtual workshop for your organization, we'd love to do both of those things. To book us, you can send us lines to ihupodcast@gmail.com. Before we talk to Kat, we're going to talk to you about some other things, just quickly.
Grandma! Yeah. Are you a hoe?
So, Hoe of the Week is where we shout out the homies who have supported Inner Hoa Uprising in the past week. Hoes of the Week get special nicknames, and the game, if they choose to participate, is to guess the meaning behind their nicknames. So, this week, we have Scarlett, who became a patron on Patreon. Scarlett's nickname is Hotaku. I'm pretty sure that the Scarlett, who is the patron on Patreon, would get this nickname. But if this is a different Scarlett, then I apologize to both of you because I have just fucked up. But that's the name of the game today. So our next hoe of the week this week is Mitsumasa, EW. Your nickname is Anno, and Anno sent a PayPal donation and a really nice letter, and the letter said, oh my god, I just lost my job last night, but I'm listening to the dawn of the new Inner Hoa Uprising, which I love you calling it that, and it gave me strength. I love you all, and as a Japanese-American non-binary person who likes science fiction, thank you for naming the BS that is regressive cyberpunk. You're welcome. I got fired essentially for being trans at work after we just had a sexual harassment training where trans people are now included in protections in the state of California. I'm very sorry that happened to you. So the future is definitely not here, especially not when white liberal bosses are transphobic, racist, and uncomfortable and want to look inclusive. They gave me my workplace accommodations for my brain injury the same meeting 5 minutes before they handed me my workplace termination. That is some shitty fucking shit. Fuck those people. I love you all. Good work. Keep going. You are the future. Thank you. You are the future as well.
You keep going.
As well. Exactly.
You keep going, for real. I'm sorry that happened.
Yeah. Gotta fight them.
Oh, God.
Oh, I hate tech bros, man. Okay. Our other hoes of the week this week are Voorheesy whose real name is Jason, but honestly, we might change your name to Deep Voice over here. Mm-hmm.
Radio personality.
Radio personality Jason G. Ooh, yeah, who yeah. sent a- You getting into it there, Rob?
Yeah, no, sorry.
Jason, in addition to being a Patreon, also sent a PayPal donation this past week. Thank you very much, Deep Voice Jason. Also, shout out to Koriqua, whose real name is Corey, but I like to have fun with people, so that is Corey's nickname. Corey has carved out a Dungeons & Dragons community amongst our patrons. It is aptly named by myself, of course, Sex Dungeons & Dragons. So if you'd like to join this community and you are a patron, message us on Patreon or shoot me a DM in Slack, but thank you very much to Corey for carving out this community within community. I think that's very cool. Also, Koriqua and Vorheezy were first and second place winners of Jeopardy this week. Sometimes we play Jeopardy with patrons. If you were a patron, you would know that. But here's how you can become one.
Hold on.
Yeah.
With Corey, I just want to personally say thank you because he's very randomly kind of like hit me up on Twitter one day and I'm like, who the fuck is this? But he's been very supportive of me as somebody I truly don't know. It's very nice to have people who care about your well-being outside of the podcast. So I want to personally say thank you. I do appreciate it.
Koriqua with the double thanks this week. Woo, look at you. Look at you.
Out here.
Right? If you would like to be a hoe of the week and get a cool nickname, here are some things you can do. You can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. You can feature us in an article you've written or shout us out on social media. These are non-monetary ways you can support us. We love monetary and non-monetary support, and we understand that in the end of times, which is what we are living in, monetary support is not feasible for many folks. Please do not spend your last dollars on us. Put you and yours first. But if you can spare some change, here are some things that you can do to donate to the cause that is Inner Ho Uprising. You can donate to us on PayPal by going to paypal.me/innerho. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/innerhouprising, the links to which are in the show notes. And also a reminder that if you do become a patron on Patreon, for $2 a month, you can participate in things like our Slack chat, our patron-only film nights, and for $5 a month, you can join our Monday night Zoom hangouts, and at any Patreon tier, you can receive access to our episodes a few days early, entry to our workshops and parties, and entry to our pre-episode hangouts. All right, so we're gonna get into our topic of the day now. It is called Fuck It, and today the dancers have had e-fucking-nuff, okay? We're talking all about the Portland strippers and labor organizers who are leading the PDX stripper strike, a movement that seeks to create fair working conditions for Black and Indigenous sex workers. And here to talk more about this is our new homie, Kat. Kat is the founder of Haymarket Pole Collective. She is a mixed ethnicity Black cis woman from a small town. Kat uses she and they pronouns, found refuge in the anonymity of adult entertainment. Now wielding a decade's worth of experience advocating for and building a reputation within the adult entertainment industry, it is this next part of the journey which is most exciting for them. An accomplished artist, an award-winning stripper, can't wait to talk about that, Kat has been everything from a sailboat deckhand to a middle school teacher, to a gallery curator and published playwright, to a big booty hoe and workers' rights advocate. Welcome, Kat. We are so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So Kat, that was a extensive bio, and last night, but when we were talking about this, me and Rob were both like, Kat does so many jobs. Our running joke is that Rob has like 5 different jobs, but Kat has like 17 different jobs. So if you want to just put into your own words, let us know like who you are. How would you describe yourself?
I would describe myself, I recently heard the term openly Black in a news article and really cracked me up. So now I'm introducing myself as an openly Black sex worker. I have a lot of mental illness in my family and in myself, and that has resulted in me kind of working in a collective mix of jobs that allow me to work around my own needs. And it's been really great to have the autonomy to kind of choose how and when my labor is used. So sex work has really provided me a more consistent work space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing a little bit more about this multifaceted person that you are. I really appreciate the fact that, and this is something that like sentiments that's been mirrored by other sex workers who we've had on the show, but working within sex work and finding different realms of how to participate in capitalism and finding different outlets for like how to engage in labor as folks with, whether it be like mental illnesses or physical disabilities or anything of the like. Can you tell us a little bit more about your journey to becoming a sex worker and like kind of like this labor evolution that you've had throughout the course of your life?
Yeah, for sure. I was working in small town Minnesota and not making ends meet. You know, I was working all the time, every day, and just not, you know, minimum wage is $7.50 federally. And that's just not enough for anybody to live on. And so trying to afford my life with my ex-husband was really difficult. And a friend of mine, who I did not, you know, I'd known them for years and I had no idea that she was a stripper. And I was like talking about my need for money and she was like, oh, you should just come up to Minneapolis with me one weekend and see what it does, what's up with it. And I think I made like $300 or $400 my first night and really realized that, you know, I could start working part-time in my square job and really to make ends meet. But I was driving back and forth to the Twin Cities, which is about 2.5 hours. So I would drive up to the Twin Cities, work a weekend, turn around, come back down to my small town, and then work my square job the other days of the week. So I was really on 7 days a week, but my marriage was really crumbling, and suddenly I had cash in hand and a savings. And I just remember I was going to stay in Minneapolis an extra day, and my ex called me to get me to come down to drop off some money, something, and I was like driving down to him, having like a full-on panic attack, just not happy, really miserable. And I pulled over on the side of the road and I was like, girl, you got arms and legs. You got a pocket full of cash. What are you doing going back to, you know, being miserable? And so I literally pulled over and was like, nope, this ain't it. And so I started doing sex work full-time and filed for divorce. And I was working in clubs in Minneapolis where there was, you know, a really good mix, I would say, of it was way more diverse than the clubs in Portland. You know, I would say it was like a 60-40 mix of people of color and white folks. But I specifically remember when I went up to go audition to get contracted, my friend who was white, I was like, okay, what do I need? Do I need heels? Do I need a thong? Do I need all this? And the first thing that she said was, you're going to need a wig. And I was like, really? And she was like, yeah, no, absolutely. Like, you will not get hired with your curly hair. Like, that's not going to happen. And so that was like my first time buying a wig. I had natural hair and I got a wig and it was really cool to be up there. But I remember like a really busy night and I just wasn't making money. There was no sales coming in and we were kind of sitting against the wall. All the dancers who didn't have a dance were kind of sitting against the wall. And I looked down the line and I realized brown butt, brown butt, brown butt, brown butt. Like all the people not busy were like the hottest bitches who were brown. And I just remember having a manager try to like steal $300 from me. And I was like, cool, give me a receipt. Like if this is all fine, then just give me a receipt. And he looked at me and said, where are you going to go? And I was like, dang, man, this sounds like my ex. Like, this sounds like some abusive stuff that, you know, really skeezy partners would use. And I just realized that, you know, there's only 4 clubs in the city, you know, of Minneapolis. And so it was like, how much ass am I willing to kiss to be treated like shit? Which I think is something that brown folks experience at in any labor form. And so I really decided that maybe I needed to find some place that at the very least I could be out as a stripper, right? I was having to tell my landlord I was a waitress. I was having to, you know, tell my friends I was a hostess. It just wasn't as accepted. And so I had to decide between, you know what I mean, passing as a civilian or passing as like a mixed race person who had a blonde wig on. And I decided I, you know, really wanted to pick one and try to be out as a sex worker. So I came to Portland.
Definitely compared to Minneapolis as well. How was your first time stripping in Portland and what did you notice?
My first time stripping in Portland was at Safari, which is now torn down. My first time working in Portland was I had been living up in Seattle and trying to do weed sales. And I just like did not like waking up every day and couldn't make the money that I was used to making. And it's really expensive to live up there. So I drove down to Portland to check out some clubs. And I stayed at the Super 8 next door to Safari. I didn't realize it was a strip club. So I like went in there for breakfast. And the booking manager was at the bar. And so I came in. And they were like, hey, you're hot. Do you want to dance? And I was like, sure. And they were like, cool. Can you work tonight? I was like, no, maybe like tomorrow. And I just remember, so Minneapolis only has static poles. Not many people realize that the poles spin at some clubs. People are like, how are you doing that crazy upside down shit? It looks so graceful. It's because the pole spins. but in Minneapolis, it was static poles. So I come in. I was booked without an audition just because I was hot and confident. And I came in and I threw my whole ass weight into that pole and I like trebucheted myself off into the wall. It was so embarrassing. I was like, oh my God, I swear I've won competitions before. Like, this is not me. I just didn't realize it was a spin pole. And that club really, it allowed me to be really myself and sort of choose my own music and do all this other stuff. So when it was starting to try to shut down, I went to go audition at other clubs. It didn't take me long to realize I was kind of done being not openly Black, you know what I mean? Being just like covertly passing. And I was really impressed at how quickly my shifts got cut. In Portland, took my blonde wig off and went from having Saturdays to having no Saturdays. I mean, this is something that I feel like brown folks know, like the position has been filled sort of thing. The hiring sign is in the window, but they're not taking resumes. Mm-hmm. And clubs would be like, yeah, just send a picture over and then never hit you back. And you would see, you know, little teeny boppers, blonde with fake tits, getting hired for a Saturday, like on the spot. And it's like, wigs are expensive. Passing is expensive. Straightening your hair is expensive. I guess I assumed that this was a mecca for strip clubs. And it was specifically for white strippers is what then I realized. I was really lucky to work at a club that was more diverse first so that I could have some perspective on what it should be like.
I'm glad that that was your first experience there. Who put you on to Portland? Like, why did you think that it was a mecca for stripping?
I tried to go audition at a club in Seattle, but you have to get a license in Washington in order to dance. Oh. So I went for like an amateur night and there was supposed to be a $300 cash prize. I really needed the cash to like help pay my rent. And I went in, tried to audition, and they told me, they're like, oh, yeah, the cash prize actually will go towards paying for your license. And I was like, cool, I don't want the license. I want the money. Cash. Just give me the money. And they were like, oh, you don't seem like an amateur. And I was like, what does that, like, yeah, I'm not willing to be taken advantage of if that's what you mean. Like, the sign says, you know, that I can just work one night and not have to, you know, do all that rigmarole. So then I started asking around and people were like, yo, Portland, they have a ton of clubs. You'll find some place down there. And so, yeah, I just came down to check it out. I call it titty tour when you go and you just spend like $50 at a couple of clubs. And so I ended up working at Sassy's for about 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So that kind of leads into our next question, which is, who makes up the stripping and maybe even greater sex work economy in Portland? Like, what are the dancers like? What are the bouncers like? What are the DJs like? Like, give us the whole layout of who's involved. Like, who are the key players?
There's an estimated like 1,800 dancers in Portland. There's about 50 clubs, something like that. And each club has a different amount of dancers. I would say that for the most part, it is people between the ages of 18 and 35. A lot of it is people who are, it's all that they do. You know what I mean? They are gold star strippers, that this is really all that they do. And it's their only job, which I think is pretty pretty unique, that in other cities is sort of a give and take. But it is, like Portland's demographics, you know, it's like 20% non-white, something like that, and at max. But I feel like the clubs maybe have one brown dancer. Some of the clubs have, like, there's one club with a brown DJ, but a lot of the clubs, like, won't play rap music. And part of that is because there used to be like a city ordinance that if you had an incident at your club, that part of the punishment for it was fines and then not being able to play rap music for X amount of days. Okay.
Just some blatant racism in public policy right there.
Straight up and down. They got sued up and down about a lot of other racist things because it was the gang enforcement task force that sort of led that policy, and they actually got defunded with the, you know, like 2% cuts that happened from the Portland Police Department, but it was still in practice. There's not many clubs owned by Black people anymore at all. There's a couple of people of color who own clubs, and there's definitely clubs owned by women. Mary's is the oldest club in town, is family owned, and it's lady owned. They are great and hilarious, but I feel like Portland sees itself as very progressive, and so if they don't see the issue, it's not happening, right? And so because they don't have brown folks in those spaces, they're like, well, we're not racist because we've never had brown people in here, so we can't be racist if we haven't been racist towards somebody. So I feel like a lot of the industry is like white tattooed models. A lot of times it's called like the floor model or the look. We're a rock and roll club, a lot of them will say. So like, you're not the look.
So what's the relationship like between all these players? Like, how do they treat each other?
There's a little bit of crossover of dancers at different clubs, that they'll work at multiple clubs throughout the city. And so because it is part of the tourism industry, there is a lot more acceptance from the community. Like, people come into strip clubs on their second date and sit around and drink a beer and then leave and don't tip or sit at the stage. Like, it's just like a regular bar with boobies out. For the most part, dancers have a lot of opinions about each other because we've all worked together or know somebody who works with you, or they know somebody who knows somebody. But for the most part, it's like, don't ask, don't tell. A lot of the bouncers, unfortunately, you know, like, are... not to talk shit about bouncers because they're the ones who protect me, so I gotta be careful, but there's like a lot of failed out cops. There's a lot of people who lean towards a more like conservative and racially specific viewpoints.
Very interesting layout of the scene. A reality show that might get a little uncomfortable at times, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds like, sure, some of those bouncers might have been at the Capitol January 6th. Oh, that's all I'm going to say about
that. Straight up.
Yikes.
So we know the people who are operating the industry itself. Who are the people who are patronizing? Like, so many of these clubs seem to be serving a white audience. Are there mostly white patrons?
I would say that it's mostly white patrons. And I mean, honestly, I don't think that's for lack of trying. I just feel like if you get a side eye every time you come into a club, you get patted down or told that you can't wear your hoodie at a club. Like, why would you go there to spend money? So there's, I think there are certain clubs that have more Black patrons. But for the most part, it's also like tourists, people like Canadian holidays, bank holidays do really good down here because they come down from Canada for their time, for their vacation. But I think part of the problem with this like centering of the Western beauty standards and of just gender politics of like wanting people to be totally femme presenting and things like that is part of the reason why people talk about the industry slowing down, because we're still aiming for these like Wolf of Wall Street types that do not exist anymore. You know what I mean? It is they, them, and their clique coming in to have fun and throw money, and they want to hear Cardi B. They want to hear NWA. They want to have a good time and see that the dancer is having a good time, not just the same girl on a Harley, you know, with a million tattoos and fake tits.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, it's so odd because, like, when you were like, some clubs just can't play rap music, I was like, what is stripping without like hip hop? I
don't like, even without, like, all of these songs that mention that are big literally ass booties, about, like, what? What do you dance to?
And also something that I mean, I think is super true is like, I might not be able to dance to hip hop. They might tell me that I can't dance to hip hop, but somebody else totally can. And one of the things I used to try to do was when I could pick my own music, I would try to do a whole shift of hip hop without an N-bomb to show these white folks that it was like, I'm sorry, seeing a white person dance to This Is America, Black Man Get That Money, and I'm sitting there on an empty stage and they're dancing to that. And I'm just like, oh. And they were like, no, I mean, that's, you can't claim a whole genre of music. I'm like, no, I mean, there is, get the radio edit, find the song that's for you. You know what I mean? There is so much that you have access to. Why can't you just let us have this one thing or like be in solidarity with us? I did have a good experience in Portland one time. We were, it was a whole shift of brown girls. One time ever in my whole career of dancing, the whole shift was brown women. And it was like a morning shift on a Tuesday again. And it was like the three of us that all worked at the club.
But was it lit though?
It was lit. It was so much fun the whole time. It was so fun. Because we were like, you know, 5 minutes into the shift, we all look around and we're like, is this everybody? This is everybody. Let's get it. But yeah, I think that the patrons are changing, that sex work is becoming more accessible and more acceptable for a lot of people. And so, like, we had a family come in one time that was four generations. The son, who was the most embarrassed, was probably like turning 21. His mom, her mom, and then their grandma. So the great grandmother of the son, who was probably like 96. It was her first time in a club. And I swear all the dancers were like, can we get, like, we will, no charge. This is your first lap. Like, you, please, let me give it to you, please. And so I do feel like there is, you know, it's just the most primal form of entertainment, booze, bodies, and bump and beats, you know, it's the three B's we all need.
I like that. I'm going to use that. It might end up in my, Instagram bio.
Absolutely.
So apologize in advance. But, besides Minneapolis and Portland, where else have you danced? And like, what's the differences?
Yeah. I have not really danced anywhere else. Like I said, I tried to dance in Seattle.
Maybe in like communication with other strippers across the country. Have you heard of any like tangible differences where you can say like, okay, that is not how it's done in Portland, or wow, they're doing that in Atlanta?
One of the things I was surprised by more than the differences were the similarities, because a lot of the differences are just from like local code of what they can get away with. But I was surprised at some of the common language, like rock and roll club is something that they use in Boston too. That's not the look. And just the quotas that exist. And something that's really different about Portland is that people can kind of be like, fuck this club and leave. Excuse my language, but that they can go someplace else. And that doesn't really exist in other cities. So there's a lot more that people have to do to maintain their positions in other cities to try to like please managers and things like that. And because it's so open here, like we can go complain to the local paper about it. Whereas, you know, my comrades in Philadelphia got a citation for like nudity in public because they was dancing in a park for their stripper strike, which we did with no problem, you know, all over Portland. So I think that there's just a big difference in how people are seen, which provided us with a lot of ability to kind of get the community to sign on to our ideas.
And, you know, as we were kind of like turning the arc in this conversation and getting into the activist work that you've done around sex work and stripping in Portland. But just to get a little bit more into the lived experiences of Black and Indigenous and queer strippers in Portland, we've touched a lot about the blatant, though covert, racism, colorism. Are there any instances of queer phobia or transphobia that you've witnessed in these spaces?
I mean, absolutely. I don't think that sex work provides a barrier to phobias for anybody, which is really too bad. But I do think that there's, especially in just like openly misgendering dancers who identify as non-binary or trans, but they live in femme-presenting bodies. And so a lot like referring to dancers as the girls is something that has really been a problem for me, but also just like not booking trans dancers. And we do have, because we have clubs that are male presenting clubs or male assumed clubs rather, there is an assumption that those trans dancers should just go there. But like, if you're femme, they're not looking for you. And so I'm not trans, but I do know that a lot of my friends who are and who dance have had trouble just being open and being out at the clubs that they're at, because it's sort of like, you know, if you pass, just don't say anything about it. And it's like, nah, I don't have to put on a full mask. I can be my authentic self and still deserve dignity and respect for my labor. So I just feel like the transphobia is an exclusionary thing at this point, that there's almost, it's similar to the Black folks, that they're like, oh, we've never been racist. Well, that's because you don't have any Black people in there. We've never been transphobic. Well, that's because you've never booked a trans person. And especially the danger that comes with potentially like being outed by a club and by your community, even though you still might be able to maintain your workspace, people start whispering about shit to customers. There's also just issues with homophobia that, you know, they're trying to present this like ideal femme who is horny all the time and wants all the dick. And so if you're gay, you know, they don't want to hear about it because, you know, then you're not the person that they want to jerk off to, I guess. I don't even know what their motivations are with that. But it does seem like the idea is that having a homogenized workforce will solve problems because there isn't a lot of differences between people. So if we have all the same sorts of people that are all cis, femme, skinny, the same look, we know that that will make money. There's no risk in it. But like I said, the culture has changed so much. Like if we are the Mecca, if we are the, you know, the place that people look up to as like the most strip clubs per capita, we need to start setting a higher bar for what we expect for our inclusion.
No, definitely. And speaking of inclusion, I do know that disabled dancers have been almost completely erased from the stripping conversation and the sex work conversation. So have you witnessed any ableism in any of the spaces that you've worked in?
Yeah, definitely. I can think of, there was one club that I worked at that actually was ADA compliant, and they had a stage that was wheelchair accessible, which was pretty nice. Cool.
That's nice.
But also, like, if you can't climb to the top of the pole, because we're really like pole trick heavy city, it becomes really difficult for people with differences in ability to work in that. I knew someone who, I don't really want to speak to her medical status, but she had limited mobility with one of her arms. And she found that there was a lot of places that, you know, wouldn't book them, but like she could pull with the best of them. She was had a very similar ability level. And I remember somebody asking her how she pulled with a hand that has limited mobility. And she was like I do everything else. It's not some sort of hurdle I have to jump over. It's my life every day. And I just remember thinking about her fondly all the time. If she's listening, hey, yo, you know who you are. but again, this was the industry that she was able to find that the biopolitics of our bodies being used for labor didn't have to be adjusted so much in order for them to be fiscally able to live their life. And that, you know, needing to go get medical care and take 2 months off, there's not many industries where you could just come back and walk back in to work after 2 months. You know, and that is something that's really cool about sex work.
Have you found that that is also a similar case when it comes to strippers of size?
Definitely. And I just don't understand. When I think about capitalism and the free market, we don't want a whole wall of just Rice Krispies, right? Cool. It's like six different brands of Rice Krispies. Nah, we want Fruit Loops. Friday. We want, you know, cornflakes. We want granola. There's all sorts of things that and a taste for every season. So providing one type of product, for lack of a better term, seems so wasteful to me for that space, and having a difference in like, and just that our whole job, we walk in, we pay a stage fee, right? We pay to work there. If somebody wants to sit and pay to work there and not make any money, that's on them. But these people who have differences in size, who have differences in mobility and ability and cognitive processing, know how to work 10 times harder. You know what I mean? They know how to make the money. So the question is, why don't they just trust their contractors to know their own bodies and to know their own business? You know, because my ass is my job, and in my personal opinion, the more ass, the better. And there are some clubs that do hire people of different sizes, but I definitely, I know that they face a lot of flack from customers. I know that I've personally been to, like, I am skinny. I've been told to, like, wiggle my arm like this, and they'll, like, tickle the bottom of my arm to see if it's flapping. Oh, keep it tight is something that I saw in one contract that I was like, I don't know how, what is the definition of that? Like, I don't even know what that means. But because Oregon is an at-will employment state, even though we're not employees, they'll use that as a reason to just slowly cut off your shifts. And if it's not financially feasible for you to stay there because you can't get enough shifts, then they're like, oh, well, it's on you. You weren't making the money on a Tuesday morning. And so I think that's something that is nice that we have so many clubs, because if you go out past the novelty clubs that are downtown and go into more the blue collar area, those clubs really, they just want your stage fees. And if you can make money, you can make money. Mm-hmm. So it is cool that we have a little bit more accessibility because of the number of clubs and the number of dancers that all these clubs need to stay open.
I think about just like the future and like what things could be a lot. And it's so amazing that Portland is this space where like y'all have the most strip clubs per capita, and how much more amazing and cool it would be if the strip clubs actually reflected a diverse array of dancers. Like that, I would be like ready to go there post pandemic immediately. Like I would be on the next flight to Portland.
Straight up. And that's what I've been saying is, you know, when they're worried about like, oh, you know, business is dropping off, I'm like, maybe you're catering to the wrong crowd, fool. Like, you know what I mean? Boomers are retiring. They're getting out of the game. And so the people really going out and enjoying themselves and traveling and doing things don't want a monoculture. I feel like optional inclusion does not make for an equitable experience for those people either. That just because you have a statistically significant number of brown people on staff doesn't mean that they have an equitable experience in your club or how they're treated. Just because you, you know, don't have a problem hiring a thick chick doesn't mean that they'll get the same respect and autonomy that somebody else would. So, you know, that's part of the reason why I just think it's so important for people to be trained in non-discrimination. Like, you can't sexually harass employees, contractors, customers, period. And that includes commenting on weight, commenting on, you know, how your breasts are hanging that day, things like that, grabbing asses and things like that. So
for sure, for sure. And here you are stirring up, creating some change. And then also, like, 2020 was a very change-worthy year. So is this conversation in this episode so far resonating with you? Is it helping you learn some new shit, helping you unlearn some old shit, or just allowing you to have a good-ass time? Ah, you say it is. Well, we love to hear that. We would also love for you to support the continuation of conversations like these. If you're listening to us on a podcast app, you can take a moment to subscribe to us or drop 5 stars and leave a rating for the homies. If you got a little extra change, you can drop some cash in our PayPal by going to paypal.me/innerho, or you can come join our Patreon community and access our chat and virtual events for as low as $2 a month by going to patreon.com/innerhouprising, or you can just hit up your friend and say, yo, listen to this podcast. They just had a really awesome episode with Kat from Haymarket Pole Collective. It was dope. You can do all those kinds of things to support us. We thank and love you all for your continued support. Okay, so yeah, like I said before the break, 2020 was a wild year. And I imagine as folks who work in this very intimate space that affected your lifestyle to some extent. So how did the COVID-19 pandemic, like, what was it like when you first heard about the pandemic and pandemic related lockdowns?
I was actually, I was doing work with a client when I first heard about it in like December. And I just remember thinking, I don't know, I remember hearing about it and just being like, oh, dang, this is scary. But also, like, what's really going to happen? Is it going to shut down the whole world? And as it got closer into, you know, February, January and February, it became really scary to go to work. Let me tell you, wiping down the pole with alcohol is not exactly the top line sanitation. It's hard to wear PPE when you got to get fully nude. And, you know, you're doing upside down backflips with a mask on. It was really hard to, which I think is not, you know, not exclusive to sex work. It was really hard to decide to go into work. You know what I mean? They're like, oh, it's up to you whether or not you eat and go in and make money. But it became really difficult because we're independent contractors. There, we did not get unemployment. A lot of us didn't even get the PUA that was offered. And the CARES Act specifically wrote out erotic service providers so that we could not receive funds. It made it really difficult for a lot of dancers to do anything, let alone in-person work. I have heard from some clubs that, like, for instance, dancers were told, oh, you're like too pretty to wear a mask. And so, like, managers would like encourage people not to wear. I can't speak directly about the clubs that said those sorts of things. But, you know, they've always been willing to put us in harm's way to make their money. And I think that it really, there's a certain amount of privilege that comes from being the skinny white chick that can go work at any club, because you're like, oh, I can get the shifts. Why would I cause a fuss about anything? But this really brought their vulnerability to the forefront, that they could no longer have this, you know, idea that they would just be protected by their staff or by their clubs. Now we're having to work outside. Like, they've set up tents and dancers have to be outside butt naked, which cannot be good for our health. And then, you know, you're paying still $25 to go into work, and there's nobody there because people aren't going out. But if you don't show up for your shifts, you won't be rebooked. And so there's a huge issue of people who don't want to go online. Like, a digital presence is permanent. I can throw on a wig and fake eyelashes and enough makeup and heels for you never to know who I am. So a lot of people who are parents and who are, you know, teachers and nurses and all sorts of more sensitive industries aren't able to sort of sneakily do sex work online because, you know, we'll be outed and then potentially lose jobs or housing and things like that. So it's been really interesting to see how things have moved online and also how we refer to them as the civilian community, have moved into like OnlyFans that people have always seen like, oh, stripping is a backup. And now they can like do it online through OnlyFans. And what I don't think they yet realize is the stigma that will follow you through your life. Like, no one will ever let you forget you made porn. No one will ever let you forget you were a stripper. But why would you want to forget that is my big question. But I think the pandemic has also made people realize that they have the ability to define their own outcomes, that they no longer have to go to clubs and say, oh, you know, this is what we want. They can just go online and set up their own system. But there's a lot of hurdles to that as far as, you know, internet accessibility, good cameras. Those things are all expensive. And for people who are used to in-person work, it's just become so dangerous. You know, it used to be we just had to ask about your last STI panel. And now it's like, when were you last COVID tested? And so that sort of in-person work has become so difficult. And I don't think that there's been any protection for full service, street-based sex workers at all. You know what I mean? They're still on the streets and we've always been risking our lives. Violence is a huge problem throughout our communities for all sorts of reasons, but medical violence is a real thing. That when I go to the hospital, when they find out I'm a stripper, they won't give me pain meds. They won't give me certain things. They won't, you know what I mean? They're like, oh, maybe you should stop drinking. I'm like, I'm here for a broken leg. Like, this has nothing. What medical, you know what I mean? So I had a doctor tell me once, and it was at the beginning of the pandemic, I was really sick. And I had a doctor tell me that it was just really disappointing and a waste and that I was better than this. And I looked her in the eye and I said, is that medical advice? How is this relevant to my treatment? I also know that, like, how do you contact trace for a girl named Crystal and a guy maybe named Craig? Like, how do you contact trace when it's such like an underground industry that is so quiet? So it's just been, hard and really dangerous.
So the other part of 2020 was the Black Lives Matter movement and all the protests that were happening. So in Portland, what was it like when the news of Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd hit?
It was really difficult to see a bunch of people. And I think that this is true everywhere, but I mean, especially just because Portland became so active in the Black Lives Matter movement. It was so hard to see the people who had like reached out to grab my hair or like told me I was real articulate. You know what I mean? Those microaggressions that you hear from day to day. And then those people are coming to me to be like, can you believe that racism is a thing? Yeah, I do believe it. And I also believe you told me to be quiet about it like a lot of times previous to this. Like, this isn't a bandwagon I'm jumping on. It's my survival every day. And Portland became it was really difficult, more difficult than usual to be brown in Portland because there was an association with the riots that were going on downtown. So there was a lot of people who had mixed feelings about those actions and how effective they were because going to the grocery store, you know, you'd get more sideways. People were more open about being racist because it was like you had to pick a side. And so that became really hard. But I also think that there was a huge issue of, you know, the person who started down at the JC every single day was a Black mother. It was Black folks down there fighting for their lives and for their dignity and for their kids' lives. And then the Wall of Moms shows up and they're all white. And people are like, oh my God, the moms are there. Well, the Black moms have been there. Like, there was a reckoning to be had about white saviorism within the community that was really, I think, difficult for fragile white people to deal with. And they've been doing okay at trying to learn and to you know, err on the side of listening to Black voices. But I mean, I now own 2 gas masks. There was tear gas in neighborhoods. Like, the air would get spicy, we called it, around like maybe like 10:30. You could start smelling the tear gas drifting down the streets. And I think especially for the houseless community downtown, they were almost entirely displaced. And not by the riot. Let's be very clear. Violence would not have occurred if the police had not been so aggressive. Like, the police are the problem, not the protesters. I just want to be super clear about that. And it was like, you know, they showed up singing and dancing, and then the cops would show up in their riot gear. And one of the things, one of the chants that was really common was, why are you in your riot gear? We don't see no riot here. And they just, it was really cool, though, to see Portland reckoning with the idea that racism went deeper than the police, and that there was something that each individual could do to be not just not racist, but anti-racist. And that was something that was really cool. But then now the election is over and people are like, everything is solved. And there's not people showing up to hand out coats to the homeless that are still down there. And I mean, there is Creme Brulee, amazing human being who is doing a lot of work and has throughout all of this. But it really, I feel like it changed a lot of people's day-to-day lives from being just go to work, come home, to go to work, come home, change into your Black block and get downtown. You know, people realize that they really could, you know, make a ruckus in a way that was beneficial to their community. So that was really cool.
For sure. And we've just seen, like, in this country in general, that ruckus kind of like echo through all of these different industries. I know I've seen it in the podcast and media space, and it seems like the work that you're doing is very in line with causing ruckus, good ruckus, and bringing these ideas about racism and anti-racism to the stripper sector. So how's that been? When did you start doing this kind of work, organizing around sex worker rights?
PDX Stripper Stripes specifically started, I would say, after Blackout Tuesday, which I think was June 3rd. And all these white folks posted their black squares. And you know what I mean? It was cool. Cool, cool. Really glad you're here. Also, like, not enough. And discussions started being had about how much is enough. What is the work that needs to be done? And the response of a lot of people was like, oh, no, it's just the police that are the problem. Like, if we just defund the police, it'll be fine. And it's like, nah, you have more Black Lives Matter signs on your building than you've ever allowed Black people in. Mm. So what are you doing to provide for Black lives outside of our deaths? How are you keeping us alive? How are you encouraging us to thrive in our lives and to not actively stand in the way of that? You know, and I think that it was so hard for a lot of people because they were like, you know, what can I do? I just work here, right? I'm just trying to get my bag, you know? And if I cause a ruckus, I lose that bag. And I'm like, yeah, that's the thing we face every day. But I don't get to put my color away. I don't get to put my edges away. I can try, but they don't lay flat ever.
I feel you.
And so that choice to put yourself in a position that is hard, I think was really, I was surprised, to be honest with you. There was white dancers who straight up wouldn't go back to work and call their bosses and were like, what are you doing about it? And Mary's Club was the first club to sign on. They had no questions for us. I was like, hey, are you willing to sign on? Just do better. in your own right, just be open about that you need to do better. Everybody needs to do better. Is that cool? And there was a couple of clubs that were like, yeah, absolutely. And I was so surprised because we took bricks through windows in the civil rights movement in the 60s. You know what I mean? We sat at lunch counters for this shit a long time ago. And so there are laws in place to protect us. We are a protected class as people of color. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, followed through, but you can't discriminate based on race. Mm-hmm. You can't discriminate based on gender. And there are a lot of policies in place on a federal and local level that say, as a place of business, you have to have a written policy of what happens when you break those rules. And so we asked these clubs, hey, do you have a plan? If something go, you know what I mean? Racial tension is gonna, it's rising. Do you have a plan for what to do if that comes to your place of business? And a lot of the clubs straight up said no to us. But the funny thing is, we were only asking for compliance with the law. So when we came to them and said, hey, what's your plan for this? And they would go, no, 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 that's too expensive. We can't do that. It's like, oh, okay. So you're just signing off that you're like straight up operating illegally. It was really enlightening to see the people who didn't see the problem or the solution. And it was just really hard to bring it into this sphere because people were like, oh, you know, stripping, what, you know, what does that have to do with racism? Well, racism permeates. We live in a society, in a culture of racism built on white supremacy and built on the backs of so many marginalized communities. How would it not permeate everywhere? It became really evident that we wanted to go back when we reopened the clubs, when we reopened these streets, when we reopened these gyms and bars, that we want to go back on a different foot. We want to go back not to a place where if we bring in a 20 that's suspect, we're going to get our neck kneeled on, you know? Strippers understand 20s and being, you know what I mean? We get fake 20s all the time and we don't kill anybody. So just saying.
It's pretty easy not to do, right?
It's pretty easy not to do. And I think that because our community experiences so much violence, it was something that the white community had of sex workers could vibe with a little bit more and didn't have to be like brought into the idea of violence being perpetrated against you because of who you are. And there's no amount of, you know, good behavior that's going to save you. So I think that it was possible because our city is so accepting of strippers.
So can you actually lay out all of the demands specifically that your strike has made to comply, well, for the clubs to comply with?
Anybody can look it up. We're haymarketpoll.com. We're named after the Haymarket Affair, which was like 1912 in Chicago. So you can check out our website for this as well. We have our demands in Russian, which is a really common language here, as well as Spanish and English. And these demands were voted on. We kind of looked at what the actual policy that we could enforce was, just because it was really scary. We're independent contractors, not employees. So it became really difficult to figure out where the line was of advocating for ourselves and still being protected from retaliation. And so our demands are pretty simple. We're asking, number one, for a company culture of accountability. And that should include a transparent, forward-facing policy and procedure for ongoing cultural sensitivity training, including but not limited to race and sexual assault awareness and response. So we are asking that the policies against sexual harassment and racial discrimination don't cover independent contractors. They only cover employees just by employment law. So we were asking that the clubs extend that coverage to their independent contractors as well, because they should have it in place legally anyway for the rest of their staff. So it shouldn't be difficult to provide for other people who do labor in that space, and to post those trainings and policies for the public so that when the public walks in, they know who to complain to if the bartender spits in their face or some shit like that. Like, how do you complain and what is the policy for that? We also requested that all contractors receive a copy of their contract at the time of signing, which is not a common thing. They don't give us copies of our contracts. I encourage anybody who's listening who is a dancer, if you have a copy of your contract, we would love to see a copy. if you are booking at a club, make sure you take a picture of your contract when you sign it, because that's as close as you are going to get to a copy a lot of times. So we ask that all contractors receive a copy, and we ask that all staff be required to read the literature that we provide, which are documents and testimonials from dancers of color. And then our other demands are to consider equal shifts for equal work and due diligence for booking shifts with regional population statistics in mind. There aren't that many Black folks in Portland, which is why it was so frustrating. When this all went down, they were like, there's no Black dancers here. How are we supposed to hire them? But they're telling me, a Black dancer, that. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, that's not a thing. So considering equal shifts for equal work, and then also maintain compliance with Oregon Law SB 726, which is in regards to due diligence towards removing discriminatory practices and preventing further noncompliance. And that just means that a neutral policy is not enough anymore. You cannot just say, oh, there's not really a policy about that. A lack of policy is inherently neglectful. And so there has to be a written policy to address these issues so that it's not just some random bouncer making a decision off the cuff, so that it's not just the one manager that's working that night making a decision about, you know, something serious, that there should be a written policy so that when it comes back to your business, people know what to do and how to act appropriately, because people are wild sometimes. And then the last one is to maintain and establish compliance to, and then there's a whole list of Oregon laws and OLCC policy, which is our liquor board. And really, that's all that we were asking. We just wanted compliance with the law, because it's the law, and there's just no HR department at most strip clubs. But one of my goals personally was, I've lost too many people. All the funerals I've been to in the past couple of years have been Black dancers or Black people who are within the strip club industry due to like medical negligence. And I just never want there to be a dancer at 2 a.m. crying in a dressing room, not knowing who to go to and being asked, like I got asked in Minneapolis, where are you going to go? Who else are you going to go to? I want them to know that they can come to us. I want them to know that there's somebody who will listen and help them with their options. Because the long-term feasibility of the Black Lives Matter movement is writing it down, making sure that because we live in a free market and because we live in a capitalist society, to work to make sure that the systems, while they still exist, protect and cherish the most vulnerable among us.
Right. And, you know, as you're getting at, some of these clubs were just like, nah, we can't. How much pushback have you received since asking these demands of these clubs? And have you asked all clubs in Portland? Like, what is the scope and what's the ratio of people who are like, yeah, we can do that, versus the people who are just like, nah, we're not with it?
And this has been a whole process. Part of the struggle for me personally, as a neurodivergent, mentally ill, full-time sex worker of color who is low functioning a lot of the time, I call it the Arby's example. So if you go to Arby's and they got six steps up to the front of their business, you don't have to be in a wheelchair. You don't have to see somebody in a wheelchair try to use those stairs. If you go inside and say, hey, Arby's, I'm pretty sure you need a wheelchair ramp, they cannot not serve you. They can't spit in your burger. And it's not your job to tell them how high the ramp is supposed to be, what the grade of that ramp is supposed to be. We're a protected class. And there are laws in place that define how we should be treated. Those laws are not enough. But it's not our job to help a business get in line. Like, that is the business's responsibility. That is in the city code. And my big question in all of this has been, where is the city? Why hasn't the city been enforcing and making sure that these things are followed through with when they're handing out not only business licenses, but liquor licenses to these businesses? And it became a question of, am I focused on educating white folks or am I focused on Black liberation? I really tried to center around Black liberation. We have provided a lot of trainings to people, and it's the businesses by law have to provide these trainings to their employees at the very least, maybe not to their contractors, but we do have free trainings for sex workers who want anti-racism training. The pushback...
Oh, well, what will the cost be? And the real question is, what will the cost be if none of your dancers show up for their shifts? We get to decide who we pay our stage fees to.
I think what the clubs realized was that, you know, our dancers here are super progressive. We a bunch of woke bitches. So it was really cool to see them realize that they could go pay somebody else. And what are you going to do if we don't pay any stage fees to you because you survive off of our tips, off of our whatever? And then the bartenders also want the tips from us. So we really hold a lot of the cards as far as moving staff from one side or the other. But I think a lot of the pushback was just around, you know, thinking that they didn't need it. And we lost Dominique Dunn, say his name, was shot by two white folks outside of a club in Portland. This club had nothing to do with it, okay? This was in the parking lot.
But I think it shows it's a really sad example of how escalating racial tension and escalating white supremacy and domestic terrorism is slowly going to affect us all. So whether or not you have a Black staff, you still probably want to be trained in how to respond to somebody who's spitting slurs every other word.
I think that I feel like we've contacted a lot of clubs. It's really hard to get in contact with these clubs. And one of the things I've asked is, you know, if it took 5,000 people to get a hold of one booking manager, how is that dancer at 2 a.m. crying ever supposed to? If it took us marching in the streets, if it took us walking a mile in our pleasers and like literally shaking our ass on the highway, how was somebody who was afraid for their life ever supposed to get this help? And so part of the problem is that that communication doesn't exist. So when we mail out our demands to the business owners and they say, oh, we've never heard of stripper strike, I say, well, that's funny because we contacted your manager 30 times today. If your business was on fire, how long would it take before somebody called you? Like, what will it take before you start waking up to the fact that there's a lack of communication? Because it's going to come back and bite you. So either get on board or, you know, go out of business.
So with this campaign, what do you want the end state to look like?
Part of what I'm looking at is building a framework that is sort of tri-purposed. Looking at supporting Black, Indigenous, and trans dancers in their home lives, supporting them through mental health care and resources for that, supporting them in their work life through written policy changes at these clubs. But very specifically, I'm looking at building a scaled-out certification process. So if your club makes certain amounts of money, you should be expected to be able to do more. But, you know, say you just did the training. Well, that's a silver certification, sort of like the LEED certification for environmental standards in buildings. Like, people should be able to know and look at a business and say, I know that I'll be treated equitably here. I know that when they say the position has been filled, the position has been filled. And I know that because it's documented, right, of what their policies are. And if those policies aren't enough for you, cool, that's fine. Don't go to that business. You know, we can vote with our dollars in this system. So I think it's I think building that system is really important. I also, super funny, people keep asking me these things and I'm like, man, just anything other than this, it's been horrible. I did not expect to spend my 2020 not on the poll. I did not expect to be doing spreadsheets and looking at legal counsel and contracts all year. But what I would really like is some sort of certification process to remove the question marks out of people's minds so that we can support businesses who are doing the active work. But then more importantly, defining our own outcomes so providing people. For instance, we just did a $590,000 grant to provide COVID testing and emergency supplies to sex workers of color. We need to mitigate the harm from not only from the past 500 years of oppression, but this pandemic affects Black communities the most. So I'm really looking at providing long-term support services for the communities so that they can have the autonomy and the space to thrive.
And, you know, I guess the work that you're doing is very local and specific to code that exists in Oregon. But do you have any plans to bring the PDX stripper strike movement out nationally and even globally?
I mean, I like to call it, I'm a very ecologically minded person. There's a word called abiogenesis, and it's the idea that if the conditions for life are right, that it will spring up in multiple places. And I think that that has happened. There are a ton of autonomous collectives that have existed before us and that exist now. Stilettos Inc. out in Philadelphia, Stripper Strike Chicago, Stripper Strike New York, and then there's a movement down in Atlanta. There's SWAN, Soldiers of Pole in California. They're amazing. Check them out. There's a movement towards contracting in a lot of different industries. So I feel like it is going to change, but we right now, because we're a 501c3, we only have purview in Oregon. Like, we can only serve folks in Oregon. So it becomes really hard to fiscally support other movements outside of the state. But there is a lot of crossover happening. The Black Sex Worker Collective in Nevada also has been hosting like weekly meetings where it's on a national level. We used to have weekly meetings on a national level, but we have been expanding and trying to provide a framework. But honestly, I'm exhausted. Dakari out in Chicago is amazing. They and Linzo are doing just sort of a mutual aid effort out in Chicago. And there's only like 4 clubs in Chicago. It's super Black there. It's been really hard for them, especially for thick girls out there. And it's been a struggle to try to, you know, I heard the term build the plane as we take off, you know, so like I'm trying to hold the wings on and people are like, how do I fly this thing? I'm like, I'm trying to help, but it's just there's not enough of me and I have a lot of help. But I think that the best thing that people can do to make sure that those things happen are to donate to mutual aid funds, Stilettos Inc., Chicago Stripper Strike, Soldiers of Pole, Black Sex Worker Collective, and SWAN Nevada are just a couple that I can think of off the top of my head to support. So there is a national movement, and internationally, there's a lot of collectives, Berlin Strippers Collective, East London Strippers Collective.
Thank you. We'll definitely put links to those folks in the show notes.
So what do you think that the post-pandemic strip scene will look like in Portland?
It's going to be a beautiful day. Like when everybody's vaccinated and like no more masks. Oh, I mean, people are going to be litty no matter what. You know what I mean? We're all going to be going out and doing everything. But I do think that it's going to be really interesting because we haven't had the financial support. Our industry has grown so much out of this. We're not just on pause. There's a lot of movement happening. And so I think that the post-pandemic strip scene is going to look, I think it's going to look a lot more brave. People are realizing that they can complain about their bosses, that they can ask for more, and that they have protections in that. So I think that's going to be really cool. I hope that it's more diverse. I also know Portland's lost a lot of Black folks. Like, people are moving away because it's just not safe to walk these streets when Proud Boys are riding around in their trucks. I hope that Portland stays brown and gets more brown and that the Black folks learn to thrive here like they have in so many other places. And I think that the scene is going to get a lot more queer. It's going to get a lot more thick. It's going to get a lot more Black. And I think it's going to get a lot more attention to the clubs that wanted it, that didn't fight tooth and nail, right? Because it's so it's so easy to stay with old news, you know? But being those people who set the high watermark, I think those are going to be the clubs that survive. A lot of small businesses aren't going to make it, to be real with you. You know what I mean? Good or bad. And so the businesses that really work to include more of the community are going to just thrive. So I'm really hoping that we see that change in the strip club industry as well.
And what does the future look like for you? Is there more organizing in your future? More dancing?
Yeah. I mean, I'm still survival sex working just to pay my bills. And I'm a CEO, man. It's been crazy. I never thought that I could do this work. And it was out of necessity that I started working in it. So I'm really looking to continue trying to experience as many different nuances of the sex work community as I can. And I mean, honestly, if I could work myself out of a job, if I could, you know, make things safe for brown folks, like then let's start working on other folks. You know what I mean? And my work is going to be trying to uplift those people and show them that, you know what I mean? That I've moved hurdles out of the way. Like I've hit so many hurdles along this way. I've hit so many glass ceilings, and I just would like to move those out of the way so that as other folks get into this work, that they can do it more easily because it's been hard.
One final question before we let the folks know where they can follow you and support PDX Stripper Strike. We have to ask, award-winning stripper, when did this happen? What is this award that you won?
So I would say there's two types of pole awards. There are the like pole studio type things, and then there are the internal strip club competitions. And I competed in Minneapolis a couple of times and here in Portland. So it's mostly by round of applause, but still counts.
I mean, that's what it is. Round of applause, shorty, make your ass clap. Like...
I was a finalist in Miss Exotic Oregon, maybe Miss Erotic Oregon. I don't know. I like honestly don't even remember. But I did my qualifier was Prince, and I made like a whole beautiful thing. I'm from Minneapolis, so I got to represent. And then for the finals, I just went a little too hard, and I did like trashy Trump. And it was like a little too real. I took my blonde wig. I turned it around. I had like a long ass tie. It was a little too on the nose. You know what I mean? Like I just remember some guy walking up to me, and he was like, he saw me from the back, and he was like, "Ooh, hey, baby." And I turned around and he was like, oh no. But that was really great. And yeah, there's a whole industry of competitive pole dancing. It is headed to the Olympics. I'm absolutely certain.
Love it. Love it. Love it. All right. This has been an amazing conversation, Kat. Thank you very much for joining us here on Inner Ho Uprising.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Let the folks know where they can follow you on the web and where they can support Portland Stripper Strike and Haymarket Pole Collective.
Yeah, we are on Insta at PDX Stripper Strike. I'm on Insta. My personal Insta is at cat.hollis, cat.hollis. You can check out Haymarket Pole at haymarketpole.com. Our website is in flux and built by strippers, so please forgive us. There's volunteer opportunities, and we are a tax deductible 501c3. You can donate through our website, Haymarket Pole. We are on Twitter, Haymarket Pole, at Haymarket Pole. I'm not on Facebook, but I think we are on Facebook at Haymarket Pole Collective.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for listening to our interview with Kat and listening to another episode of Inner Ho Uprising. If this episode made you laugh, helped you learn something, made you feel good, made you question yourself in a good way, or positively moved you in any sense, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, and let everyone you know that you love these hoes. We appreciate you all, and while you're at it, go drop some change in Haymarket Pole Collective's donation box. bin, plate, whatever, because they're doing really, really good work and we appreciate them.
And if you would like to follow us on social media, you can do so at Inaho Uprising without the G on Twitter, Inaho Uprising with the G on Instagram and Facebook, and you can join our Facebook community by searching Inaho Uprising Community, that's spelled C-U-M-M-U-N-I-T-Y. I haven't done that in so long. And also head to, since 2020, and also head to InahoUprising.com to pay a hoe.